is Alex, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NADA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I have seen tonight's speaker listening at quite a few of these Blue Chip speaker meetings, and I'm very excited for it to be his turn to speak tonight. And with that, we have Wes coming to us from the Primary Purpose Group in Newnan.
I'm Wes, alcoholic. Glad to be here back at NABA. I've been coming to NABA since 1989, seriously, probably since 1998. It's where I really got sober. I just am forever grateful to this place. And my home group, as was said, is the Primary Purpose Group in Newnan, Georgia. My sobriety date is July 17th, 2015. That's not my first sobriety date. It's my most current one. And this is probably my least favorite thing to do. I don't know why it never gets better, but when I start thinking about backing out or canceling, calling and giving an excuse I'm sick or something, I always read this in the Dr. Bob's Nightmare. It says, I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learn to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in doing so, I'm paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. And four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. And those are the reasons that that I always show up and always say yes when I'm asked. And also, I've seen I've had such great examples here at NABA. You know, Tommy, Frank, everybody here that I see, you know, a lot of people out here that I've seen for a long time. Tim, you know, I came here, I've been back for years, and I came back maybe the first time 6 months ago, and I see both Tims still up here, you know, after 15, 16 years, being of service and still leading this meeting. So very grateful to have those examples. And my story, what it was like in a general way, what it's like, what happened and what it's like now. I was born in Pittsburgh in 1976. I'm 47 years old. It's weird saying that still. My mom was from Pittsburgh. My dad went to school up there. My dad was an active alcoholic, fairly violent one, and after a particularly brutal kind of incident with him and my mom where he was going at her with us in front of him, she moved us down to Rome, Georgia. My dad's mother and father were down there and gave us a house to stay in. And that's where I grew up for the most part until I was about 15. And, you know, the more I tell my story and the longer time goes by, the better childhood I had. I had a really good childhood. You know, I didn't have anything major, no abuse. I had a mom that always worked, wasn't there a whole lot in the house. I kind of was raising myself with my sister, but she was a good mother and took care of us and did what she could. You know, I was more of a kind of mischievous kid. I was always trying stuff, kind of out there doing whatever. And back then, like, we would come home and just basically she said, get outside until it gets dark. So I'd stay outside. I lived in the country and was always running around, riding my bike and doing stuff like that. And I played sports. I was never real good at anything. I was always pretty average at stuff. You know, I just never had the discipline to be great or really good at anything. But I never really had any trouble. I went to it was back then in the early 80s, it was pretty segregated. in Rome. So there was a black part of town and a white part of town. We lived in the black part of town, and, you know, I lived right by the projects. I went to a white school, so I kind of had a weird, you know, kind of, I already kind of felt different and separated, but you know, it was a different kind of time back then with the kids in the project. They were pretty rough. The women were rough. I remember in seventh grade, there was a girl that decided she was going to be my girlfriend, and I was like, nah, I don't think so, but they went and caught one of my friends and beat him up because they couldn't find me, and so there were some pretty rough ladies over there. And, you know, all in all, it was good. When I was 13, my mom moved us out more into a nicer part of town where I was hanging out. And the first kind of real sign of trouble, like we had broken up some people's houses, kind of got caught doing that, but didn't get in any trouble. But when I was 13, there was another kid that was 15, and me and him were just kind of talking and hanging out and about how we hated living in Rome. There's nothing to do there. And we ended up coming up with a plan that we're going to, you know, steal his dad's van, take all the money out of his dad's, you know, whatever safe or whatever he had the money and run away and go to California. And I had started playing guitar when I was 9 and was decent at it. And the goal was I was going to be out there and be a rock star. I was 13 years old. Get out there and be a rock star. And then I'd take care of us once we got out there if he got us there. And we actually made it out to Los Angeles. He was a 15-year-old and I was a 13-year-old. We made it out there and got caught within a week. And thankfully, because I think we had about $15 in quarters when we got caught. We got caught. The police said our parents could either pay for us to come back, or the state, we could stay out there in YDC, and the state would ship us back after 2 weeks. Our parents brought us back, and he immediately kind of went to his dad, went home, and just went out and did whatever he wanted to do. My parents told me, hey, we're going to go take a trip and talk to some people, and that was over to Ridgeview, and we got there, and I stayed, and they left, and I ended up staying in Ridgeview for 2 months. And at this time, the first time I'd ever drank was in when we were out in California. I drank some gin, and I really didn't like it. You know, it didn't taste good. I did get drunk. I liked the feeling of that, but I don't remember any, like Joe and Charlie and their tapes talk about how wonderful alcohol makes you feel and all that stuff. I don't remember that being the situation, but I'd never done drugs. I'd always been kind of scared of smoking pot. People had offered it to me before. So I'm in Ridgeview, and that's when they mix the psych ward with the drugs back then. Like under 18, they mix psych and drugs. My roommate would always, him and his little friends would always be talking about, telling stories about using drugs and doing this and doing that. And I wanted to fit in, so I started, you know, making up stuff and telling those stories too. And then he went and told on the people to me, told them, hey, look, this guy's fed, he's in here for psych, but he's actually done drugs. And they confronted me about it, and I went along with the lie and ended up getting treatment for a lie, just something I'd never done, and went to aftercare for a whole year on it too. And so that was kind of the beginning. But the first time I went to AA's, when I got back out of treatment out of Ridgeview, I went to an AA meeting, and for being in that town where it was real segregated, and just that was the first place I'd ever been where I felt like accepted. Like there was no color, no nothing. I felt true like acceptance and love in that AA. And I was probably the youngest kid in there by 20 years. But I went to AA meetings. I didn't really have a problem at that point, so I didn't think about it too much. Just was doing it because I had to. And yeah, my dad used to always tell me, he's like, Wes, you're going to get in trouble one day, and I'm not going to be able to help you get out. And he was constantly saying that to me because of the way I was behaving. And I never understood it till later on. I did pretty good for the next couple of years, got arrested for selling pot. I started trying to have a little business. I was always trying to make, you know, a little bit more money than I had. I think my allowance was probably $5 a week. You know, I got in trouble when I was 15, got arrested, put on probation, and my dad decided I'm going to come live in Atlanta. You know, I came up here, and he's a really strict disciplinarian. And I think my grade point average was probably, yeah, I don't know, maybe 1.0 or 1.2 or something like that at that point. So he got me on a path to straighten everything up and start to improve my grades. And kind of rode me for a couple of years, and probably those were the two most miserable years of my life to this day, just because he was just such a taskmaster. When I was roughly 17 or so, I was basically just dry, raw nerve. I couldn't get any relief, and you know, I was somewhat depressed, I would say, but more of that showed up as like irritability, restlessness, discontent, not necessarily sadness. I started drinking again on the weekends. That took the edge off. I started selling drugs and got into that heavily. And then I quit high school right before I was about to graduate and just figured I'd go off and, you know, make a living selling drugs. And so that's what I was doing. Throughout that whole next year, like I'd never tried drugs up to this point. I'd been drinking. Lightly, I had done a little bit of acid and stuff like that. I'd never done anything serious. I didn't like pot. I talk slow, walk slow, so I don't need to be any slower. So I didn't like anything that slowed me down. I tried cocaine for the first time. Like it says in the book, where he tried gin and sedative and he was on the rocks. That's what happened. Yeah. And I figured out it was really hard to sell cocaine when you were doing it. And same thing with meth. I started doing that, and I had a very short career with that stuff because I got super spun out. And I gotten into with some bad people, and what we were doing was going around and robbing other drug dealers. So we were stick up kids. We would, you know, rob other drug dealers. We'd rob our own customers, and you run out of customers real quick like that, and you get a bad reputation. My world just started getting smaller and smaller to where I couldn't go anywhere because you know, without somebody looking after me, because there were people trying to get to me. I had stopped doing all drugs and was just basically drinking every day, just hanging out with my girlfriend. And I knew something bad was going to happen. I just didn't know what it was. I could just feel it. And we'd done so much stuff, I didn't know exactly what it was. I had a series of arrests, just stupid stuff. Like I got arrested on the same road. We got pulled over 3 months before. Cop wanted to search the car. We told him he couldn't. Somehow he agreed to let us leave the car there if we got somebody to come pick us up. And 3 months later, he pulled us over. He's like, I can't even believe this. It was the same. We were in the same car, same expired tag, same suspended license. And I took off running, and they beat me sober and took me to Cobb County Jail, and I got out and kind of moved on with my business. But about 19 years old, still heavy into the robbing, I was going one night just to pick up some wine or beer from the store or something like that. Came out with my girlfriend was with me, and the cops pulled up and started questioning us. And ultimately, I'd given them a false ID, and she was jerking them around. So they arrested us, and we had some pot in the car, just like a small, like a pound or something like that. And they got us to the police station, and I figured that we were going to be in and out of there. And then they started reading, the radio came back and said, you know, John Wesley Hauser, black male, 6'1", wanted for murder, armed robbery, and then I had some other charges too, some trafficking charges. You know, that took a minute for that to sink in, but that thing my dad had always told me, you know, that one day you're going to get in trouble, and you're not going to be able to, I'm not going to be able to help you. You know, the work that comes down to is, you know, my associations, you know, if you put yourself in a situation and it's you or somebody else, it's typically going to be them, you know. So this was just a self-preservation thing. And so I ended up in Rice Street for 18 months and just waiting for a trial. The detective came to talk to me when I first came, said they didn't want to talk, so they didn't hear anything else from him the whole time. And at about 15 months of being in Rice Street, I'm glad I didn't get out of jail early because I didn't have any bond, because I would have got out and done the same exact thing over. Thankfully, I stayed in there, and I was trying to manipulate my way out and get answers, and I just couldn't. Nothing was happening. And about 15 months, I got into they had a treatment dorm in there on the sixth floor, so I was able to go to meetings, you know, three or four times a week with outside people, and then we would have meetings in there. It was kind of a crazy situation. We got a bunch of inmates running the program, but it was better than being in the regular dorm. I was in there, and I remember I was just struggling with trying to manipulate the situation and get out or figure out a way to, you know, work through my charges and you know, it was really, it was a lot to bear, because I didn't know if I was going to be there for, get a life sentence, which was one option. Just the trafficking was a 10-year mandatory minimum. And I'd kind of come to terms with that, but just the not knowing was bothering me. And you know, I'd had no court date, no information. And one night I got on my knees and I said, you know, if there is a God, all I'm asking is that just take this from me. I can't, I don't want to do it on my own anymore. It's too much to be worrying about every day. And I just let it go. And I said my first honest prayer that night. And the next day I got a court. You know, things worked themselves out. And eventually I, they dropped the charges because they didn't have any, there was no evidence. Two of the guys were dead that I knew, and the other guys were gone back to Mexico. So, there was nothing there. And, on the trafficking charge, the money and the drugs had somehow got out of the evidence room. So that got dropped. Fulton County was a mess back then. I ended up still having a marijuana charge. I got time served on that. But the problem was is that when I was using, I couldn't show up for anything. And I'd had a probation that I was supposed to show up for in Cobb County. I just never showed up. So I had a hold and had to go back to Cobb County. Got to court there. The judge said, you're going down the road. She gave me a 5 years, do three. Bounced and went down to Jackson for diagnostics. When I got there, there was two books. There was a Bible and a big book. You know, I started reading the big book, and I read it from cover to cover. And I think it took me, I don't know, 30 days, 20 days, something like that. But as soon as I finished the last story, they shipped me off to Buford State Prison, which is where I did the rest of my time. I got out of there. Right before I was about to get out, I was all about going to AA, doing what I needed to do, and my dad was talking to me right before I got to get out, and I was thinking, I don't think I need to go to AA. I was like, I think I got this. And fortunately, the state said you're going to a halfway house, or you're going to go to a state sanctioned one. You can pay for it, or you'll go to one from the state. I chose to get a job and, you know, go to one I pay for, and I went to Primary Purpose, and I stayed there for 3 months. Then I went over to Hope Homes for, and I stayed there for about 3 years. So it's similar to like an SLA type deal that some of you guys are in. And I stayed there for a good 3 years. And getting into the steps, I started out at the Triangle Club. You know, that was a little bit wild for me over there. I ended up getting a sponsor who basically everybody thought he was real goofy, but when I heard him share and I looked at him, I saw that he was honest, and you know, he shared from the heart, and I related to him. And with the admitted we were powerless over alcohol, then our lives had become unmanageable. He explained that to me, that the unmanageability is what I want to happen. It wasn't happening, and what I didn't want to happen kept happening. And that was the story of my life. You know, I kept going to jail. I kept losing relationships. I wanted to show up for court, but I couldn't show up for court. When I did, I showed up drunk one time, and so I was just, it was just constant, you know, and then that was pretty easy for me to admit. I know people, kind of like my dad was an alcoholic, and he had gone to school, got out, and done a lot of the things that he was supposed to do, and so it was harder for somebody like him to see, but it was real easy for me to see, you know, that my life was unmanageable and that I had a lack of power. The second step, I didn't really have a problem with God, I don't think. I think this part in Bill's story summarizes it pretty good. It says, the word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar in the heavens, however loving his sway might be. And it says, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me. Fortunately, AA was able to meet me where I was at, and you know, my sponsor had said, hey, look, use the group as your higher power. And that I could get with. You know, I could come here, like tonight, we've got 30, 40 people in this room, and I knew that when I came and I sat in the rooms of AA, there was something here that I couldn't get by myself, you know. And that was a power greater than me, so I could hold on to that. And then the third step was explained to me that, you know, made a decision to turn our will which is my thoughts and our lives, which is my actions, over to the care of God as we understood him. And, you know, I really liked everything that kind of goes into the third step when it, you know, goes from page 60 to 61 where it talks about the actor. You know, the good news is, it says, so our troubles are, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. I was thinking about that the other day. Every problem I've had, I haven't had any real deaths in my family, or, you know, it's all been self-imposed, or I've caused all my problems, and nobody else has. The fourth step, the searching and fearless moral inventory, was big for me, you know, and it wasn't that I felt, fourth and fifth step, that I felt this huge relief, the unburdening, which I do think I did get some relief from that, but the thing that I felt was, it was the first time I'd ever done anything as I was supposed to do it. I'd never followed directions or done anything like I was supposed to do it in my life, so I was proud of that, you know, I was happy about that, and I'd done, you know, what I was supposed to do, so I think that worked for me. The sixth step and the seventh, or something that I still am working to understand, but, you know, I did what I could, and I think I did the best job that I could in that at that time. The eighth and ninth, you know, all my amends were pretty easy. It was, you know, family, a few friends. I wasn't going to go back to people that I used to deal with on the streets, talk to them, but all my amends went pretty well. I didn't have anybody that was really salty or anything and got on to him. The tenth step, just the continuation of the fourth. The 11th, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, has taken on a much bigger meaning now, but back then, I don't really remember. That was in the late 90s. Yeah, it's just hard to remember. Okay, but the one important thing here is on the 12th step, when we got to the 12th step, I balked. I'm not doing that, and I just wasn't willing to do it. And my sponsor sat with me for about, you know, 2 weeks or a month on that, and finally he's like, look, I can't work with you anymore if you're going to balk on this. And I think I was about 2 years sober at the time, so he got rid of me. He fired me. I ended up just kind of sponsoring myself for a little while. And I met a guy at the Biscayne Room one night. I was about 3 years sober, and he talked to me for about 10 minutes. And then he said, he's like, I'm going to be your sponsor. He's like, because you're going to drink. I don't know what I said. I probably was just telling him how many meetings I was going to, that I was, you know, if I had a sponsor, just some basic questions. Whatever I said to him, he was real concerned and told me, you know, he thought I was headed for a drink. And you know, that man, I believe, saved my life, or at least saved me from going out and relapsing a lot faster. He had no opinion one way or the other about this, a group that's been kind of banned from every clubhouse he can be banned from. But they straightened me out, and they taught me a level of service that sticks with me today. You know, and I'm definitely a proof that, you know, you can relapse and still some stuff sticks with you. And so for the next 2 years, basically, I got a sober job where I went to work at a certain time, left at a certain time, and left it at work, and I did nothing but, you know, run around and be of service in AA and try to chase down drunks. And it taught me that every time I'm in a meeting or every time I'm somewhere, I need to be ready and reach my hand out to help the new guy. And after about 2 years, I dropped out of that group because they had wanted me to tell somebody to stop taking this medicine or something. I was like, I don't think I can do that. So I kind of moved on. But the basic benefits and things that they taught me stuck with me. And you know, I had a great 15 years, if you don't count prison times, 18 years if you do. You know, the next years of my life went really, really well. You know, had real good success in business. You know, I came out of prison with GED, no usable skills. You know, I was real country, so you could barely understand me. I mean, it was like I wasn't even speaking English at the time. And I had nothing going for me. That's what was kind of funny about that. I didn't want to do the 12th step or work with other alcoholics, because that's really the only thing I was uniquely qualified for, was to help another drunk. I mean, that's the only skill I had and the only benefit I could be up to somebody. And once I did that, it taught me a lot about myself, and I learned a lot and grew up in AA. And, you know, at about 12 years sober, I
I think it was right around then I got married. That didn't last very long. Last about 8 months. And during that breakup, I got through it, and I think because of AA, I was able to do it with grace, kindness, and you know, do what I needed to do to make sure she was safe and get her off on the right foot. But I don't think I really dealt with the pain of it. Then I started kind of separating from AA. I was still going to meetings, not being honest with my sponsor, not getting honest with others, making more money than I ever made. I was doing really well. You know, it talks about, there is a solution, more about alcoholism. You know, Jim, I was in Texas working. Somebody handed me a drink or, you know, whatever it was. And it says, I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. You know, I took it. Kind of alcoholic and addict I am. I'm not like a binge drinker, not a part-time guy. I'm somebody that will use every hour, every minute of every day until I'm physically stopped. So I have to either be locked up in jail or a hospital, or, you know, I've got to be physically removed from the substance and not able to get to it. And that started after about 2 weeks, I knew it had me again. That was at 15 years sober. That started. My life was a lot different, you know, than I'd had just had a child. You know, that started a 2 year basically terror, you know, like it talks about in the last part of the book about, you know, the four horsemen. I'd never experienced that before, but now I got to experience the, I think it says terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. I started losing days because I was mixing, drinking, and benzos, and had some opiate-like stuff going on there. So it got bad. I got to that jumping-off place for a while, you know, where it says, he cannot picture life with or without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life with or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. I was started on a path back to prison too. I got in 2 DUIs like within 3 months apart. One up here in Gwinnett for driving on the wrong side of the highway. And then one down in Grantville, which I don't know, that was the first time I've been to Grantville. But I remember getting into my car at the office and on Jimmy Carter, and then, you know, an hour later waking up with a cop knocking at my window on the side of the road, and somehow kept my license. And then because of my behavior kind of leading up to the relapse, I ended up getting indicted. I got a federal indictment, and that came down in 2016. People were definitely saying, look, you're definitely going to prison on this one. It looked like I was going to 8 years. I wasn't real happy with that, so I negotiated it down to 5 years. 5 max, no minimum. It took about 5 years, 6 years to resolve the case. But during that time, you know, I got sober about 6 months. I'd been sober about 6 months in before they came and picked me up. And I'm glad that I was, because there's no telling what I would have had on me if I had been drinking. came and got me. So I was very fortunate that I had just got sober. You know, I knew I had a couple options. I could live it a day at a time and do whatever I needed to do to put myself in the best position I could, my business in the best position I could, so that if I did have to go away, maybe things could last, or, you know, I could ball up in fear and give up. And the stuff was in the paper, and we have a real small industry, so it was, you know, everybody was kind of hating on me. But the only, I come to NABA every day, and the only thing I hear here is, like, hey, how you doing, Wes? You all right? And this was my, every day at 5:45, I'd be here. This was the only place I found peace, you know. And that's why I just love NABA so much. I came back, when I came back in after I got sober, I ended up in the hospital to get sober. And that's how I know that I have to be stopped. And I was in the hospital for 8 days. I came close to dying. Fortunately, my mom stayed in the room the whole time, because when I did wake up, I was trying to get somebody to bring me something to the hospital, because they wouldn't give me anything to sleep. I kept asking the doctor for something to take the edge off or take the pain away. They wouldn't give it to me, so I was trying to get somebody to come up and bring me something, but she stayed and made sure nobody came in the room. After 8 days, I got out and started going through the steps again, and I had a different experience this time with the steps. A lot of it's been similar, but specifically, like on the ninth step, I was having a hard time figuring out if what I had done wrong to people. I just only hurt myself, but, you know, somebody told me, hey, Wes, when you're at work and you say, hey, look, I'm going down the street to get a sandwich, and you don't come back for 5 days, that's hurting some people. That's making people a little bit unsure about where they work, you know, and if it's going to be there. And so stuff like that, you know, I would just had to kind of go through the steps and get a new perspective. But, you know, all in all, obviously I didn't go to prison. I'm standing here today. That worked itself out. You know, I've got a great relationship with my family today. I've got a real good relationship with my son's mom. And those are a lot of different things that could have went real south, you know, if I had kept on using and drinking. And, you know, I was able to, I almost lost that business, but I was able to revive it, sell it, and retire a couple of years ago. And it's all because of AA. You know, I had no, there's no reason I should be here or that I should, you know, that I would be here if I didn't have AA to kind of guide me. And service for me has taken on a new, I guess, urgency. I worked in the kitchen down there for a year when I first got back to Napa. The breakfast, I would, you know, do the dishes and stuff like that. I'm very involved in my home group, very involved in kind of the service structure. I take a meeting in the detox, you know, twice a month, which, you know, just gives me so much gratitude. And I sponsor guys, and I try to pass this thing along, you know, and I can never repay what I've been given. It's just been such a great ride, and I'm extremely happy that I got to come back to Napa and tell my story, and glad I could be of service tonight, and happy to see you all, and thanks for letting me share.
I'm an alcoholic, so I'm taking the Triangle Club comment personally. You did a great job. Thank you, Wes. All right, we've asked Brittany to come and do the chips.
Hey, I'm Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany. The white chip, the surrender, anyone?
Strange to me, as I rode from town to town, can't put the bottle down, right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing, need something to take the edge, you see. It's the Bible, the book, or the gun for me. Seems like everyone's out to get me. Trouble always following me. Feeling like I just can't outrun. Demons that are all around me. for the book or the gun.